from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made 2 years ago when a woman whose name is Ivana Borges learned she was pregnant and told her obstetrician that she wanted a natural birth. The Atlantic Monthly reported the story of what happened next. Borges explained that her own mother had delivered 5 children without medication or without surgery, like C-section, and she wanted to do the same at the hospital. When her water broke, that same doctor told her that the best way to deliver would be by C-section. He told her the labor was not progressing quickly enough. Ivana insisted she could wait, but the doctor responded, "You won't be able to handle the pain." Ivana labored for several more hours, but finally broke down. She said she felt too much stress and pressure from her obstetrician, and the 24-year-old agreed to have a C-section. She says her doctor thanked her, saying, quote, "I was at a birthday party earlier, and I'd like to get this done fast because I want to go back and finish my whiskey," end quote. Ivana Borges' story happened in Recife, Brazil, where the C-section rate is an estimated 82% of births. Women are routinely counseled into cesarean births in Brazil. This hour, we're looking at the rate of C-section in this country, now roughly one-third of all births here. Many medical professionals say it should be lower, but how low? How to get there? And why? One of the country's leading voices in the effort to reduce the rate of C-section is Dr. Jean DeClercq, a professor of maternal and child health at Boston University, the School of Public Health. Today, he is in Rochester. He's been speaking to OB residents, nurses, and midwives this morning, I'm told, and tonight he'll be speaking at a free event, 7 o'clock tonight. It's free. It's at the First Unitarian Church on South Winton. First, however, he's right here on Connections. Dr. DeClercq, nice to meet you.
Glad to be here.
Thank you for taking the time. And also in studio with Dr. DeClercq is Diana Young. She is the emeritus of the Birth Journal. It's a quarterly international birth publication. And thank you for being here as well.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I started with that story of a doctor pushing a mother into a C-section. And we hear that all the time in a country like Brazil with 82%. But we have seen the rate of C-section in this country, hopefully for very different reasons than what I just described, Dr. DeClercq, move from, I've read 27-28% about 10, 12 years ago to 33% now. Is that roughly right?
32.8, but who's counting?
All right, 32.8% now. It's too high?
It's too high. To put it in context, in 1996, it was 20.7%. So we're talking about more than a 50% increase since that period. It's too high in a couple of senses. There's really a good argument to be made for cesareans in a lot of cases. For instance, in a lot of countries, the cesarean rate is 4 and 5% in underdeveloped countries, and that's dangerously low. And so the question is, where do you strike the balance? And experts have come out with roughly 15% as the point at which doing additional cesareans starts to become unproductive. And so that's the challenge. That's a challenge for modern medicine. That's a challenge for modern public health, is how do we strike the balance by ensuring that the people who really need cesareans will have access to them? And at the same time, the institutional forces that get set up when you start doing cesareans, like having operating rooms, having 24-hour anesthesia, don't start pushing the system into doing more than are necessary. The trade-off is simple. When a mother is in need of a cesarean, there's a good medical reason for it, then whatever dangers might be associated with the cesarean, and there are some, there's complications of surgery, there's infections that are higher, more likelihood of transfusion, those are offset by the dangers associated with whatever the medical cause was. When you start doing more and more cesareans and they're not for medical reasons, then all of the risk is being borne on the side of the surgery and not to offset some other possible danger.
And I opened with that very extreme story of a doctor telling a mom, "I was at a party, I want to go back and finish my drink." We hear all the time that in Brazil they schedule cesareans as if they are dental appointments, and that it is viewed by the medical community there as something that should be convenient for doctors. I don't know if that is sort of a caricature or if that's actually happening, but I would hope that that doesn't happen here.
Yeah, that doesn't always happen in Brazil either.
Okay.
Though I just actually was in Brazil this fall.
Okay. But the rate is very high there, isn't it?
The national rate is 52%.
Okay.
And unlike the United States, where the rate has leveled now for the last 4 years, it's continuing to go up. And what you have is this massive distinction there between public and private hospitals. So in private hospitals, the national rate is between 85 and 90%.
Okay, in public. Okay.
And in public hospitals, it's more in the 40s. Now, in the 40s is really high as well, so that suggests there's a general culture. But there is this big divide between the public and the private sector there.
Okay. Do we hear any stories here? I'm trying to make sure I understand the reasons then that if the rate of C-section in this country is 33% and it should be lower, and we'll talk about where we think it should be coming up here, but you would think that there are lots of different reasons that it has climbed to 33%. For example, maybe moms are older, and just trying to sort through some of the numbers. Here's the Centers for Disease Control in a paper published last May. They write the first birth rate for women aged 35 to 39 increased from 1970 to 2006. It decreased from 2006 to 2010, but increased again in both 2011 and 2012. The first birth rate for women aged 40 to 44 was steady in the 1970s, started increasing in the 80s, and the rate more than doubled from 1990 to 2012. So are women older when they give birth for the first time in this country?
You nailed it with the figures. That's right. What isn't understood, and actually this is what I'm talking about tonight, that's one of the things I'll go through, is all of the reasons that are generally cited for it. What's not understood as well is that while there were changes in the age distribution of mothers, it first peaked in around 2003. And between 2003 and, as it noted, about 2010, it stayed the same. In that same period, the cesarean rate among those mothers went up by about 40%. In other words, the changes in the age distribution of mothers is dwarfed by the changes in practice around cesareans for older mothers.
Are older first-time mothers more likely? They are more likely to have a C-section, is that
absolutely
right? Yeah. Okay. But again, the point Dr. DeClercq is making is it didn't track evenly.
Right.
The rate of C-section was increasing much more sharply than the rate of older mothers.
Actually, if you break these figures down and you look at it by age groups, the cesarean rate between 2006 and 2009 went up at about the same rate, around 55% in every age group. And in fact, went up a little bit faster among younger mothers.
We're talking to Dr. Gene DeClercq, who's giving that free presentation tonight. He's in from Boston. He brought the snow with him. as I look out the window, no stranger to snow this season. And if you want to call the program or weigh in, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Let me ask Ms. Young, how do you view the debate about where that number is? 33% in this country, but how do we start the conversation of where it should be?
Well, I too agree that the World Health Organization came up with a figure of 15%.
15.
And actually, I got concerned many, many years ago in the mid-1970s, and at that time, I wrote a booklet which was published by the International Childbirth Education Association called Unnecessary Cesareans, Ways to Avoid Them. And that's when the cesarean rate was 13.9%. And actually, there were unnecessary cesareans being done, though the obstetrician and the obstetrical community were not happy about the idea that I could even use that term. But today there's much more recognition that, in fact, there are cesarean sections that are not being done when they're necessary.
There's something that seems counterintuitive to me, which is that the medical community is understandably risk-averse in terms of litigation, concerns about what comes out of a mistake, etc. So if you're risk-averse, you would think that a medical staff would counsel mothers and work with mothers to make sure that whatever the choice is, whether it is a vaginal birth, a cesarean, a VBAC, etc., is the choice that is the safest for all involved. You would think that. So how is it that if 15% is kind of generally a target number for cesareans, we're more than double that if the medical community is risk averse, Dr. DeClercq?
But there's risk in this birth and there's risk in subsequent births. And part of the difficulty with the rise in cesareans is that they beget more cesareans. Since mothers generally cannot get a vaginal birth after cesareans, the rate is like 7 or 8%.
That's changing, though, isn't it?
Only marginally.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Only marginally, because we hear the term VBAC, vaginal birth after cesarean, and maybe in my own sort of limited view, I hear discussion about VBAC as something that more women are being told it is possible. But you're saying the numbers indicate that the movement is very light on that.
More women are being told it's possible. It's just not actually happening. And so it bottomed out at about 7.5-8% nationally. In recent years, it's risen up to about 9 or 10%, which is an improvement. But that still means 90% of mothers who had a prior cesarean are getting another cesarean. In other countries, the VBAC rate, instead of 10%, is 35%, 40%, and 50%.
How is that? How are they at that number, and we're around 10?
Culture. I mean, this is birth is a cultural event, and it's shaped by the culture at large in terms of how people view medical care and intervention. It's shaped by the culture of the institutions that provide it. And so from the institution's perspective, there's a lot of arguments for cesareans. You can structure a workday better. You can structure your staffing better. You have certain incentives once you get to a certain point. If you've built rooms for cesareans in your hospital, then not using them is a loss. So nobody does this just to make money by any means. They make changes necessary for the institution, and then the pressures start to arise concurrent with that that lead to this. This isn't ill will. This is sort of systemic cultural changes that happen in institutions and in the society.
And convenience, too. There are certain days of the week which are more popular for cesarean sections. I remember the co-author of the booklet on cesarean, Unnecessary Cesareans, said, you should see this place on a Friday afternoon. That's when everyone goes into surgery.
So they don't have to deal with a possible birth over the weekend?
That's right, yes.
I mean, birth is not convenient, right?
No.
I mean, it's can be beautiful, it can be a challenge, but it...
But babies don't get born by the clock.
Okay. But Dr. De Klerk, that's not an apocryphal tale that doesn't hold up to reality, that... In other words, there really are more popular days for C-sections and times for C-sections?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to plug the talk, but I have slides on that, too, that I show the distribution by day of week and then by hour of the day, because there are clear patterns around that as well. And the patterns reflect, again, more institutional needs than the needs of mothers. So, for example, in one of the slides, we look at the distribution of vaginal births by day of the week. Peak between Monday and Thursday at hospitals. You look at the same thing for freestanding birth centers and for home births, and the line is essentially flat. It's flat across the days. In other words, it's an even distribution day by day.
Well, you're allowed to plug the talk, by the way. I mean, that's partially why we wanted you here, to find out what you are going to be talking about tonight. 7 o'clock tonight at the First Unitarian Church on South Winton, and that's a free program. Dr. Gene De Klerk will be there leading that discussion. He's a professor of maternal and child health at Boston University. It's the
School of Public Health.
The School of Public Health there. And Dr. De Klerk, recognized as one of the country's leading voices in the effort to reduce the rate of C-section. Diana Young is here as well. She is the emeritus of the Birth Journal, a quarterly publication. And so that's tonight, 7 o'clock. Let's look at some other reasons, though, that people seem to think that we're seeing more C-section. Number one, people think it is a birth, especially first-time birth, is a stressful proposition, and that more women are simply choosing it. Now, the all-knowing Wikipedia tells me that in Scandinavia, it's around 7% requests, but around in this country, 3% or less. I don't know what we have found, but I don't know. Let me back up and ask. Are more women asking for C-sections, especially first-time births?
Yeah, I'm actually one of the sources for the 3% or less.
Okay.
So I'm part of a group that does these surveys called Listening to Mothers. And we've asked mothers over the years at different junctures about their experiences. And this came in the context of exactly what you talked about, the suggestion that mothers are driving this. So we asked mothers two questions. One was there a medical reason for your birth? Or what was the reason for your birth? And they could list, and they listed the normal reasons. Baby might be breached, might be a very long labor. And then a small percentage of them said there was no medical reason for it. But then we also asked them, who made the decision? Did you make it before you went into labor? Did you make it during labor? Did your provider make it before? Did your provider make it during? When you combine, I made the decision before I went into labor with no medical reason, turns out it's like 1%. That same question wording has been used in other surveys, and they come up with between 1% and 3%. And so the two things to keep in mind is, one, yes, clearly some mothers are. And that's I mean, that's like home birth in that it attracts a lot of media attention because it is unusual and it sort of captures other societal trends, but it is not the driving force behind this in any way. Now, that's with first cesareans. It's a different matter when mothers had a prior cesarean, because in those cases, oftentimes all she can envision is another cesarean because she's afraid of a VBAC. But in terms of first-time mothers asking for a cesarean, it's there, but it's certainly not driving the kind of increases we've seen.
Well, let me get to some of your comments and questions as well. We're starting to see them pile up on social media, at Evan Dawson on Twitter. And the phone number to call if you want to jump in with a comment or question is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And to respond to the first comment I saw, I don't think we're trying to frame this, and I don't think Dr. DeClercq or Ms. Young are trying to frame this as attacking anyone who's had a C-section. Though I know it's sensitive, Dr. DeClercq. I mean, inevitably you must travel and speak and hear from people who feel that if they had a C-section, that it was somehow wrong. And I know that's not necessarily the message at all.
No. And I'm also on the faculty of obstetrics at the Boston University Medical Center. So, and I work with obstetricians on a regular basis. It's not that. The question is, when is it appropriate and when is it not? On a population basis, there's going to be individual experiences that are going to vary on this. But the idea is not to demonize any mother or any individual experiences. People are going to have to face the situations that they confront in their own way.
Amanda says, had a C-section for my second child. VBAC was not even presented to me as an option. Should it have been? Well, I mean, that's a very difficult question for our guest to answer without knowing more, I think, Amanda. But but let me frame it in a different way then. Do more mothers need to be given the option of VBAC? And are too few mothers given the option of VBAC?
Let me quote the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. They put out a guideline that said mothers should be offered, in the right circumstances, one prior cesarean, a transverse cesarean in the first case, the lower cut, the bikini cut that people would refer to. In those circumstances, which is usually the case nowadays, mothers should be counseled about having the option of a vaginal birth after cesarean. In listening to mothers, we asked mothers about that. And about half of them said that they were not given that option. Actually, a little more than half said they weren't given that option. Now, having said that, only about half of them said they were interested in the option, too. So part of it is mothers, there's a lot of mothers who think I'm just going to have another cesarean, or they're afraid of what might happen in a VBAC, because that's been a lot of talk of late. But at least for the mothers who want one, denying substantial proportions of them the options of having one, doesn't make sense.
What are the risks of VBAC?
It's the risk of VBAC is that you have a higher chance of a uterine rupture, which is one of the most frightening terms you could imagine, right? It sounds awful. The risks of that are low. And the trade-off is, and probably the best study was in the New England Journal in 2004 that looked at this in some detail. It said there's a higher risk of uterine rupture. You would have to do something on the order of 500 additional repeat cesareans, however, to avoid one symptomatic uterine rupture. And so that's the kind of trade-off that's difficult to make. It's easy for this birth to say, let's just do another cesarean. In the long run, and for the society as a whole, that raises more problems, because the more cesareans a mother has, the riskier each birth becomes.
Harold wants to know why 15% as a target number for C-section. Again, that's a World Health Organization number, and the United States rate of C-section, 32.8%. But 15%, should we assume that that means medically necessary, emergencies, all the other factors, equals roughly 15%?
There was two studies I just cite, one out of South America that looked at countries with different rates and associated with neonatal and maternal mortality rates. And what they found was that when rates are lower than that, that the neonatal and maternal mortality rates are unusually high. What they found was as countries started crossing the 15% barrier, first there was no additional benefit. In other words, outcomes didn't improve. And then when rates started getting very high, and in Latin and South America they are very high, that there were actually some problems that start getting associated with it. There was a more recent U.S.-based study that did the same thing to try to look at what that cut point was. And it also found that after 15%, the benefits start to get outweighed by the risks associated with it. So, the original WHO pronouncement was a long time ago, and one could understandably say that was made 25 years ago and is no longer relevant. But more recent work suggests that maybe they weren't that far off the mark in the first place.
Yeah, so when we look around our area then, 32.8% for the country, but do we know what it looks like in Rochester area hospitals, for example?
Yes, the Stronger Memorial Hospital, actually their rate seems to have, in the past 3 years, has been going down slightly. So that's good to see. Highland Hospital is about 27%. Rochester General Hospital is about 33%, and Unity Hospital is about 33%. The hospitals that have midwives tend to have slightly lower cesarean section rates. So if a woman is having her first baby and she really is keen and feels that she must have a natural birth if possible, then one of the first things that she needs to do is to choose, a practitioner who has a low cesarean section rate. And midwives do not do cesarean sections, and they care for women in a somewhat different way than obstetricians, and allow them to labor for a longer period and don't intervene medically unless it's necessary. And so the choice of a practitioner and the choice of a hospital is an important thing for a woman to consider.
When it comes to midwives, it's interesting that you hear the term midwife and some people immediately think of sort of need to know Rochester, need to know covered this a couple weeks ago. My colleague Helen B. and Duty Hofer talked to Michelle Bertner and a number of other local midwives who are doing wonderful work. And sometimes the stereotype is, as I heard someone say, a tent in a backyard, as opposed to all the various different things that are going on. And many midwives, a group, the Strong Midwifery Group, for example, delivers at Highland Hospital. So are there misconceptions about midwives, do you think, Diane?
Well, I think maybe there are, which makes it all the more important for women to get as much information as they can about what is available in terms of childbirth and where they can have their birth, their baby, and how. So I think that they can learn about midwives, and there are now certified midwives, and as well as certified nurse midwives, and there are more of them, not as many as we would like to see, but certainly they have excellent birth outcomes and a lower cesarean section rate. So that's one way of avoiding having a cesarean.
All right, so C-section rates through midwives are lower. I also see that I don't want to say for the first time, but at least in recent recommendations I've seen from medical groups, they talk about the impact of doulas, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
And here in the Rochester area, I have not heard negative stories either about midwives or doulas in local hospitals. But around the country, you read stories, and occasionally medical staffs are resistant, for example, to doulas. Dr. DeClercq, are we seeing more acceptance of doulas during labor?
We've seen it works at a couple of levels. The basic answer is yes. There's more doulas working in hospitals. But what we call a doula is a bit complex. There's a lot of different kinds of doulas. There's doulas who just work in the hospital. There's volunteer doulas who work in a hospital. There's doulas who do prenatal support and intrapartum care. And now in Massachusetts, the doulas are working with the home health folks because they're doing prenatal care, they're doing intrapartum care, and then they follow up to help with breastfeeding and transition issues for mothers. And so that's the kind of full service that actually a lot of European countries have as part of it. They don't call it doulas, they just call it home health aides, maternity home health aides, which is not a tradition we've had in the United States at all.
But bottom line, do you think that doulas are a way to reduce the rate of C-section, for example?
the rate of unnecessary C-section? Yeah, because they provide some alternatives for mothers who might not want to go with intervention on intervention on intervention. There's this what's termed the cascade of interventions that can happen, that one intervention leads to another, that an induction can lead to an epidural, the epidural can lead to an easier decision
is
to
it,
go to a
is
cesarean.
Is it true? Is that cascade something that does happen?
That there are differences. Again, I wish I could always make things simple.
Sure.
But
no, I understand.
There are vast differences with that cascade. The thing is, sometimes a cascade is necessary, right? Sometimes mothers do need an induction. Sometimes they do need an epidural, or the epidural might be used. But it's as much a reflection of a culture of an institution, whether they go down the route of saying, let's do one intervention, let's do another, let's put her on an electronic fetal monitoring continuously, let's put an IV in her arm, let's get her an induction, let's get her an epidural, and then everything slows down and somebody says, well, we need to do a cesarean. And so they do the cesarean, say, thank God we did that cesarean and prevented a difficulty.
But whereas the doula can make suggestions for a woman to change position frequently, to get up and walk in the corridor, and give her long-term sort of support, and with a focus on what she can do herself to help labor move along, and instead of a medical intervention.
Let me get to Josh's comment. Josh says on Twitter, my wife and I both had our children with the Strong Midwifery Group. Fantastic staff. They hold great birthing classes too. And Jake writes to the program, didn't I hear that there are health benefits for children that go through natural birth?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's overwhelming. I wouldn't sell it just on that. The benefits that accrue can come from, once you look at that, the same people who would probably do a complete natural birth would do a whole lot of other things that might enhance the outcome for their babies as well, including prenatal preparations,
good nutrition.
Breastfeeding, good nutrition. And so probably, but it's not necessarily just because of the birth, that's the case.
Okay. Let's get a short break in, and then we're going to come back and talk about a number of other issues impacting birth rates in this country. Where we go next, we're talking to Dr. Gene DeClercq, who is in Rochester today from Boston University. He is speaking tonight, 7 o'clock. It's a free presentation at the First Unitarian Church on South Winton about this and some other things. He's giving us a kind of a bit of a preview, but he'll be covering a lot of different subjects related to this discussion tonight at 7 o'clock. And Diana Young is also here. She is the emeritus of the Birth Journal, a quarterly publication. Short break and more of your questions answered next on Connections. Coming up tomorrow, the first hour, Innovation Friday, we're talking about accessible and affordable housing. And then it's our Second Opinion Live. We're talking cancer, and we'll be talking to cancer survivors and taking your questions. That's tomorrow on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
A new documentary has angered a controversial church.
I set out to make a film that I wanted to make, not the film that the Church of Scientology wanted to make.
The movie features members who left the church and lost their family.
I knew that they would be required to disconnect from me.
A look at the documentary later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. If you have a question, comment about your own birth experience, or joining the conversation, as we talk about the C-section rate in this country, my own experience, I've got a boy who turns 3 on Sunday, and let me just sort of ask a question that I've yet to hear answered. He was born at almost 43 weeks, which is quite a long time for the medical profession. And as anyone who's gone through that knows, that there are questions start to come up about intervention, et cetera. And we weren't anti-intervention, and this is not about my wife or me, and this isn't what the hour is about. But the question I have is that we were told occasionally by some in the medical community that if you go past 42 weeks, the rate of placental failure is a very concerning thing. And so my natural question was, I'm obviously always open to data. I say, oh, okay, well, what is the rate? And they said, well, nobody goes past that, so we don't really know. And I said, okay, but surely this must be based on something. And there wasn't any study that I could find. I'm not saying it's not true at all, but there wasn't a single study that I could find that indicates that once you pass the threshold of 42 weeks, placental failure is going to go from, it's going to triple, it's going to go to 10%, it's going to go to 25%. There wasn't anything that helped me understand what is likely, especially when we know that conception dates can be hard to pin down, et cetera, as well. So Dr. DeClercq, what would you say to someone who says, I'm concerned about placental failure too, but do we know what happens at a certain point?
No.
No, we don't?
I mean, there's studies that show, and the person who talked to you was probably absolutely correct. It's so rare to go past 42 weeks in the United States now in anything but out-of-hospital births that we don't know for the most part. One of the tricky things in all of this now is the balancing of absolute and relative risk, which sounds more esoteric than it is. Basically, what happens is we do studies and we do these analyses and we say something is double the risk that it was before or 50% higher risk than it was before. And that's the relative risk. The actual likelihood of that happening may be infinitesimally small. And that's kind of what happens in the case of stillbirth and going past 40 weeks, that the risks of stillbirth are actually higher in weeks 41 and 42, but they're still very, very low, less than 1 in 100. Closer to 1 in 1,000 in these kinds of cases. And when you're talking about that, so I just said one of my students actually just went past 42 weeks and was getting the same kind of grief. And her response when she was in her 42nd week, when someone said, well, you know, the risks are higher, she said, and I can't quote it exactly, but it was something like, well, wait a minute, it said the risks go from 0.5 per 1,000 to 0.8 per 1,000. I'm willing to live with that. Now, that's because she's anal and reads all the literature, and most people aren't going to be in the situation where they can do that. But I think people do need to understand and ask that second question. When someone says, this risk is higher, you should also ask, but what is the risk?
Yes.
And are you willing to, and if you phrase it, it's 1 in 1,000, that sounds, well, maybe it could happen. If you phrase it, it's 999 out of 1,000 times, it's not going to happen. People have a different perspective on exactly the same ratio.
Okay, well, and right, and my point was we asked that question, and some, again, certainly not all. We had a wonderful birth experience, just great, a great birth experience. And I will always appreciate the folks at Highland Hospital and all the great things that happened there. But some seemed a little annoyed that we would say, okay, but how much? As opposed to just, trust me, don't do it. Don't go past 42. Nobody does it. Schedule an induction. Get it done. You know, and that pressure, you know, we handled it. It was great, but that can be tough.
Very tough when you're in labor.
Or not yet in labor.
Or not yet in labor. Even earlier on, yes.
And so obviously a lot of couples are counseled to do stress tests. Mm-hmm. And writing in the Atlantic Monthly, the article that I referenced, one of their writers talked about her own experience and then looked into stress tests. And her concern was that there could be what they call false positives mm-hmm. in a stress test. Mm-hmm. So are there concerns about false positives? Should expectant mothers say, yes, let's do stress tests, and every day we'll check the heart rate, we'll check fluid monitoring, and as long as we're in a good range, we'll keep going. Any concerns about false positives?
It's not just in stress tests. It's during labor if a woman's hooked up to a fetal monitor, that as they're monitoring the progress of labor, they also have the issue of discerning what's a false positive from an actual event. And so it's tricky because if you thought you got grief asking about what happens after 43 weeks, if you say, what's the false positive rate of this test and how relevant is that to me? Some people will be able to answer that and some people are going to get very defensive because, you know, the physicians are just like the rest of us. They get into patterns of behavior that were built up and often driven a lot by their initial training, but built up over time, and what had initially been an evidence-based approach becomes habit and routine.
But I want to be careful here, because the last thing I want to do is give anyone the impression that that patients should have an air of knowing better than a doctor or knowing better than a staff who's caring for them. Hopefully the approach is simply, let's be as transparent as we can, let's give everyone the best information we can. But we always said we will absolutely trust the people that we're going to, and we did. It's just at times it seemed harder to get some more of the information, if that makes sense.
The challenge is a structure of care now, that in the past you and your wife would go to the doc that probably delivered you. Right, that is the person in the community that will deal with all of your cases, will deal with you. Oftentimes it would have been a family physician, and they know you incredibly well, and you have a relationship. Now, for absolutely understandable reasons, essentially that obstetricians want lives like everybody else, we don't have practices where they say, I am your physician and I will be there no matter what. They're in group practices, and sometimes larger group practices, which allows them to control their lives and their schedules better. But then you're now dealing with someone you may have only met once or not at all prior to that. And it's a real challenge to build up that trust that quickly. I think that's the difficulty. They don't know you as well as they'd like to. They would like to know you better, but they don't know you as well as they'd like to. And you don't know them to be able to make that commitment that you described.
When it comes to fertility, a lot of talk about the C-section rate centers on, well, we have a more effective and progressed treatments of fertility, and sometimes fertility treatments lead to multiples, and we know that multiples tend to lead to C-sections, so there must be a correlation there. Yes or no?
Well, yes and no. Sorry.
Okay.
The yes is we did have an increase in multiples, largely related to assisted reproductive technologies. Two things to keep in mind. One, that has leveled. They've gotten better at assisted reproductive technologies. And so we're not getting as many multiples as we had, and we don't get the sort of grand multiples that we were getting of 5 and 6 kids. So that's leveled off. And at the same time, what we found was the same phenomena that I described with mothers, that the increase in multiples leveled off a few years ago, and the cesarean rate just kept climbing after. What you see is the bigger difference is whether or not multiples are delivered by vaginal or cesarean birth, and that's changed. Now they're much, much more likely to be delivered by cesarean.
Janet wants to know if epidurals are offered too much. I don't know if offered too much, what that means, but maybe we'll rephrase that to ask, I don't know, should the approach to epidural change? I've not heard that.
Well, the rate has certainly increased with epidurals steadily over the years. And
is there a correlation to the C-section rate with epidural?
That's a matter of opinion, but it looks as if some studies show that, yes, there is a correlation between an increase in epidurals and increase in cesarean section rate.
Dr. DeClercq?
Yes and yes. The epidural rate has increased. Whether it leads to cesareans is, as Dione correctly noted, there's all kinds of conflict in the literature around that. So you can find studies on both sides. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges for clinicians now is anybody can find a study to say what they want, pretty much, because there's so many studies that come out. And epidurals to cesareans is one of those areas. The issue for mothers is, do they have any alternatives to epidurals? And that's where doulas can come in. And they can make a difference in that kind of context.
Is that part of the culture that you talk about, comparing our country to others?
Epidural rates are much lower in most other countries. In a lot of cases, their obstetrical systems try to map onto what the United States does, so epidural rates are increasing in some other places. But no, they have alternatives. Nitrous oxide, which we use barely ever here in the United States in labor, is widely used in England, for example.
Is that laughing gas?
That is laughing gas.
Laughing gas.
Yeah.
Okay.
But mothers control it, and they put the mask on when they want, and they take it out. They can't go crazy with it, but it's a way for them to control, as needed, their own pain management. And in England, it's been part of the system for decades, and they're still comfortable with it, so they have a much, much lower epidural rate than we have in the United States.
All right, let me grab a phone call, and this is Terry in Rochester. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes, I'd like to ask your doctor from Boston whether or not his experiences with calcifications of the placenta were not an indication that, that there was issues past 42 weeks.
Could you ask again? Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yes. Your doctor from Boston?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I just wasn't clear on the question.
Okay. So I've been a labor and delivery nurse and have seen many placentas, and many calcifications of the placenta are a clear indication that there is, that this post-term, along with, deterioration of the placenta, the baby having a lot of peeling and foul-smelling, fluid, et cetera, et cetera.
So calcification of the placenta after a certain point, Terry, is what you're saying?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it happens. No.
That we can be cavalier about the past 42 weeks, and that we don't really know anything. But the fact of the matter is that we do know quite a bit.
Well, two things. One, the fact is we don't go past 42 weeks very often anymore. Secondly, in retrospect. What that situation is, although now typically you stop monitoring once you get past 40 or 41 weeks anyway on a regular basis to try to determine that.
Mm-hmm. But when you do see the placenta, which is an indirect indication of a deteriorating temporary organ that is meant to be temporary, one can then assume that. That it will not deliver in the same way that it did past the 42 weeks. Isn't that true?
But Terry, I'm confused. Are you saying anecdotally or based?
I'm saying that in terms of whether we know or we don't know past 42 weeks what the outcomes are because we don't ever go past. We can clearly see in the placenta that there is degradation of the placenta after 42 weeks. There are calcifications of the placenta, which is a clear indication that that will no longer function after a certain amount of time and therefore lead to death in utero.
All right, so Terry, I'm not being combative. I just want to press.
No, I hear what you're saying, but I really don't feel that, that we can afford to tell people that, you can go past 42 weeks.
You're not giving me information. If I were a patient, you're not giving me information that is clear to me. You seem to be indicating that 42 weeks is a hard and fast line and that calcifications and degradation of the placenta will happen.
It does. And your guest can tell you if you've had, any deliveries that, when you have an older placenta, that it does show signs that it is deteriorating.
So, Terry, you're saying
that is a very clear indication to me, if not to your guests, that, that this organ that was meant only to sustain the baby for a certain number of weeks is losing its effectiveness to help sustain this baby.
So the question would be, do you do that? Do you determine that by monitoring on a regular basis to check to see what the status of it is, or do you do a hard and fast line and automatically do cesareans?
An induction, right.
Induction or cesarean.
Or you collect data from your past deliveries and say on the basis, because most of what you're collecting is data, and then you're crunching the numbers and then coming up with your 15% for cesarean and so forth and so on, because that's how you do statistics. But I'm saying to you that if you find enough placentas that after 42 weeks you take them or you send them to pathology and grade them, I think you will come up with pretty good numbers to base the 42 weeks and under on that, on the basis of what happens to placentas after or during that period of time.
Terry, thanks for the call. Do you disagree with that, Dr. DeClercq?
No, my only point was whether or not you have a hard and fast rule or do you make decisions on an individual basis through assessment of the progress of that particular pregnancy.
Yeah, and so much of what I just heard it is not based on study. And I, to Terry's point, sure, I would love to see it studied. If you could start to actually study the organs after, for those that went past a certain time. But my point was, when we went through that, I didn't see any actual study that helped us understand, and no one was able to present it to me.
Given what I said before, I suspect there are some studies somewhere. There's always studies somewhere around it. The question is, how do you structure the decision-making around that? And whether or not you very rarely get absolutely clear lines that at this point in time, given the imprecision sometimes about gestational age, that you would automatically make a decision. Mm. And my point is simply you make it on an individual basis, working with the couple involved.
Is there anything to look at induction of an induction using Pitocin or something else? Does that lead to a higher C-section rate?
Yeah, that's right in there with the epidural and cesarean. People cut both ways. The women who get inductions are more likely to get cesareans, A. If it's a first-time mother, not if it's a mother who's given birth before, not a first-time mother. There's a report from the American College of OBGYN called Safe Prevention of the Primary Cesarean. And one of the things they recommend is induction. Again, with all of these things, it's not in and of itself a good or a bad. It's how it's used and in what context it's used. And the argument in that guideline is for selective use of induction to avoid cesareans in some cases. And so everybody would like clear answers all the time. It would be really helpful for the clinicians to be able to say, do this or do that. In fact, it tends to be more of a spectrum of decisions along which people will fall, and they have to make decisions around that.
Okay, so let me start to, the hour is evaporating quickly. Let me start to wind down the conversation by focusing on if there is some general agreement from the World Health Organization to many doctors you hear from that it would be beneficial to see the United States lower the rate of C-section, which, again, currently stands around 32.8%. WHO says a good goal is 15%. That's the point where beyond 15%, outcomes are not better. Even if there's disagreement about 15, maybe it's 15, maybe it's 12, maybe it's 18. Either way, we're close to double that or more. So how do you start the process? A hospital staff, a doctor, an OB staff, they may tell you it's a nice idea to want to cut it down, but at the same time, we go patient by patient and we try to deal with who needs it most. What are the effective ways to reduce the rate of C-section?
Well, the hospital itself can take some steps, and certainly if they have believe that their cesarean section rate is too high and they want to reduce it, they can get together their staff and they can talk about different training for the obstetricians in terms of management of labor. They can say, well, let's let women labor for longer rather than intervening medically or surgically which is what we've done in the past. So definitely there are ways that they can change their practices that will increase the likelihood of a woman having a vaginal delivery instead of a cesarean.
Dr. DeClercq?
There's a number of states, including California, Ohio, Massachusetts, have formed perinatal quality collaboratives where they start reviewing and discussing amongst the different hospitals what things they can do. One of the things that's been most successful is the establishment of what they term a hard stop, not doing inductions before 39 weeks unless there's a clear medical indication. And in those cases, a second person reviewing the decision to do the induction. And that's found to have two effects. One, we've cut down on the number of premature births in the United States in recent years. And secondly, it's suggested that that's likely related to the decline in, the leveling, or in some states, in Massachusetts, it's actually declining the cesarean rate.
A couple other quick comments on Twitter. Allison writes to us and says, forget 42 weeks, I hit 40 weeks and I was immediately counseled to induce.
That's not unusual. It's rare now. I mean, going past 41 is really unusual. That's why, the argument about past 42 is very, very rare nowadays.
Okay. But do you have a general problem with the idea of counseling starting right at 40 weeks?
I think you talk to your provider around that issue of absolute medical risk again. they're absolutely right that the relative risk for a stillbirth goes up after 40 weeks. The question is, are you willing to live with that likelihood in terms of a very, very low absolute risk?
Okay. And finally, one of our colleagues points out that tomorrow, Second Opinion Live on this program. Second Opinion Live is certainly a program that you'll hear on this broadcast. And one time on Second Opinion Live, Dr. Lorelei Thornburg from University of Rochester Medical Center said that cesarean is not unnatural childbirth. It's just different. That there's some who view the term natural as sort of maligning cesarean as unnatural. Is it an unfair term, Dr. DeClercq?
Yeah, I've never been crazy. Well, I don't mind the term natural as much as there's a movement to use the term normal birth, which would then make cesareans unnormal. The goal here is not to demonize people who have cesareans or people who do cesareans. The goal here is to find the right mix for everybody involved, involving the least amount of intervention that's necessary and the use of intervention only when necessary.
What do you think,
yes,
Diane?
That's what I agree. I agree totally with that, yes.
Okay. Well, thanks for taking the time here. And I think if we're taking anything from this conversation, it's not to stigmatize C-sections. It's to look for best outcomes. And right now, a lot of the literature and the analysis says we're a little too high. And that so it's interesting to see the possible ways to lower it. You can learn more tonight at that free event at the First Unitarian Church on South Winton, 7 o'clock. Dr. Jean DeClercq will be there. I'm sure there will be plenty to talk about that we have yet even covered in this hour. Is that fair to say, Dr. DeClercq?
I think so, yes.
Thank you for taking the time. And Val, great job on the engineering board today. I'm Evan Dawson. Tomorrow it is Second Opinion Live. They're talking cancer tomorrow in the second hour, if you want to join them for that. And my colleague Matthew Leonard will be here, as will I, the first hour tomorrow for Innovation Friday. Always have a lot to talk about there. Have a wonderful Thursday afternoon and hope to talk to you on Friday on Connections.